Good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. It is 7:42, so that means it is time for Greenside Up right here on the Mighty 690 KGGF. And Jesse Gilmore will be in studio here in just a few minutes, but we do have him on the phone right now until he can get into studio. And good morning, Jesse. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for asking. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. All right. So let's go ahead and get started here. A few things that you want to talk about. And there's actually a question I do want to ask you as well. And it has to do with one of your K-State minutes that you had last week that kind of interested me. And you see it all. You can see it around town. But we'll get to that here in just a few minutes. But the first thing you want to talk about was the Master Gardener program.
Yes. So right now we are in the process of for our 2020 Master Gardener training. For those who aren't aware, Extension Master Gardeners is a subset of the Department of Horticulture on campus. Essentially, what they do is they get a certain amount of hours of training in horticulture offered by different people on campus or through Extension. Usually, this is going to be a really thick handbook worth of trainings over the course of 12-ish weeks. I believe right now we are planning on the first Thursday in September to the second or third Thursday in December. And it's a little unprecedented right now. We're with COVID, we're still trying to hash out the details of the training for this year. But we are planning on doing, I believe it is synchronous Zoom classes once a week for the training. So there's no travel cost associated with it like there has been previous years. For the Wildcat District, we usually split training responsibilities with the Southwind District. So that would be Krista Harding, and it's her year for training. So I'm basically going to be support. But I wanted to put that out there because I know Master Gardeners means a lot to me because my mom was a Master Gardener, and I'm pretty sure that's how I ended up in this field in the first place, going with her to different Master Gardener volunteer opportunities. And that is part of the responsibility of being a Master Gardener is volunteer hours during the year in different gardening opportunities across the district. Some counties do not have Master Gardener programs because there's not enough interest. But with Wildcat District, there's definitely been an interest, particularly in Labette and Montgomery County.
All right. So so that is what is going on with Master Garden. And what is your I was writing down stuff and then I got distracted for a second. Your second subject that you wanted to talk about today?
My second subject is tree selection. So it seems like every time I'm on this show, I talk about trees in some capacity. And not this past weekend, but the weekend before that, I was called out to Oswego by a concerned homeowner who wanted me to look at her trees and see if there were any hazard trees. We had gotten some storms in Pittsburgh where I live, but they weren't severe. So I assumed at the time when I went out to her house that it was just going to be a couple of limbs on the ground. What I did not know at the time is that Oswego had suffered some severe straight-line winds, some measured above 100 miles per hour. And when I was driving through Oswego, it was very hard because probably about three-quarters of the city's trees had damage in some form that would necessitate their removal. So the city lost about three-quarters of their trees in one weekend. And that was kind of hard as I was driving through because I understand that especially for people who grew up in the area, there could be a lot of sentimentality surrounding their mature trees. And mature trees are really hard to replace in the landscape. It takes a long time. But there's also a really good opportunity for the residents of Oswego to basically put a unique fingerprint on their landscapes in what trees they select to plant or their replacement trees. So essentially I reached out to the tree board. A lot of an advisory tree board that essentially guides municipal decisions on what trees to plant in public spaces. So I reached out to them, and I haven't heard back from them yet, but I'm hoping to get in contact with them after the Leavitt County Fair regarding classes on tree selection and basically how to select a tree for a particular site, and also what to look for when assessing whether or not a tree could be a potential hazard tree, and how to go about fixing that so that trees don't cause damage to people or property in their vicinity.
All right. So tree selection, kind of a big thing to make sure, you know, I mean, it's, and like you said, it takes a long time for a tree to mature. It takes a while. So, 'cause some of these trees are extremely old. So Jesse, what we're going to do, we're going to go ahead and let you go just for a few minutes. So you can get back into studio, as James has now come into studio, and we'll see you here in just a few minutes.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, thanks a lot, Jesse. All right, and now joining us in studio today, as thank you very much, is James Coover from the K-State Extension Office. And Gerard, good morning, James. How are you doing today?
Doing pretty good.
All right, well, it's good to see you. It's been a while since I've actually
seen him in person. Yeah.
I know it's been a few months. So one of the things you wanted to talk about is that's coming up is the is a pickle party.
That's right. So we're kind of doing like a pickling workshop, and pickling really, it's not just cucumbers, it's so many different things. I mean, technically like kimchi and sauerkraut and fermented things. I mean, pickling, you can pickle peppers and watermelon rinds, and
because Peter and Piper picked eggs. The pick of pepper,
exactly. So I don't know, I just thought it would be fun to do like a pickling workshop and to really get into depth all the different various pieces of pickling. And it's actually fairly easy to do in comparison to a lot of other things. It's not like traditional canning, because you don't need an actual canner, you just need a hot bather, because it's all salted. So it's easier in a way to get into. And there's a lot of fermentation and other health benefits and such to go with it. So this will be on August the 15th at the Oswego Community Center. From 1 to 4 p.m. That'll be on a Saturday in the Oswego Community Center, August 15th. It's $10 cash. Of course, you'll be taking a whole bunch of stuff with you, jars of things and that. And so that's why. But you just give us a call at the Altamont office and we'll get you registered if you're interested in this. It's going to be a fun workshop. I really like doing these kind of workshops. You know, I can only get to do a few every year, so I'm happy about this one. It's going to be fun.
Yeah,
so
it's going to be a lot of fun. And then, yeah, I mean, again, finally you get a chance to actually get out into the community, because I know you guys were kept up for the longest time. I think it was July 4th was actually the last day y'all were actually not able to. We're finally able to get out into the community. So I mean, other than appointments and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but
this will be my first workshop since like February.
Wow.
So, of course, everybody will be wearing masks and gloves, all that.
Before the pandemic broke out.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But it sounds like, though, everything is going good with that. So, and that will be a lot of fun. That does sound like a lot of fun. So, James, what is your main subject today that you would like to talk about?
My main subject, though, I'm going to be talking about silage, actually, or dealing with the drought-struck corn. Some of the areas around, as you probably know, haven't had a lot of rain. It's been incredibly spotty, the rain in this area. And it seems like some places just keep on getting rain over and over again, and some places have gotten no rain. I mean, there are areas that have gotten less than an inch and a half of rain since the beginning of June. And
wow.
That's just not enough rain for corn.
No.
It's really not enough rain for the soybeans either, honestly.
Exactly.
But, I mean, and so some of them are like barely over waist tall. They've tasseled. There's no kernels on the cob. They just did not pollinate. It was too hot. It was too dry. And so a lot of them are looking at doing something with the corn, which is silage. And silage, it's basically taking the corn, chopping it up, throwing it into plastic bags, and letting it ferment. That's kind of funny. I was just talking about fermenting pickles. And it's sort of the
lots
same.
Lots of fermentation going on.
Yeah, sort of the same process. So, I mean, silage is the most common, but it requires special equipment. And so the most specialized piece of equipment that's you kind of have to find somebody with this thing is a chopper. It's like a combine, except the front of it looks very aggressive. It's got a whole bunch of teeth to it to chop up the corn, to, you know, fluff it into little pieces. Wagons to carry it back and forth to wherever it is that you're leaving it at. The plastic bags that has to go in. And so there's a whole bunch of various pieces of equipment that have to go with it, which is why a lot of people don't mess with silage, because they just don't have that stuff. Their operation's not set up for it. However, when you're making silage, the moisture percentage is very important. The moisture, I mean, it needs to be between 55 to 65%. It's not very exact, but it's you can't get away from that percentage, because if it's too wet, it's going to create this acid of sorts that's not a good acid. It's one of the bad acids.
Right.
And it also creates an environment for Clostridia as well, which is, I mean, obviously kind of toxic. If it goes under 40%, it's not going to ferment. And so it just kind of rots instead and molds. And so it really has to be the right percentage, and it has to have no oxygen.
It's very exact, basically, pretty much.
Yes. And I mean, it's not terribly hard to get between that 55 to 65%, because corn, I mean, out of the field is kind of wet. And so you just let it dry a little bit, throw it in a bag, and you'll get about pretty close to the right spot. No oxygen, though, is also very important. It's just like making pickles or making beer, right, or anything like that. There can't be any oxygen. If oxygen gets in there, it becomes aerobic reaction rather than anaerobic, and then it makes all the wrong acids. And so once you put stuff into the big plastic bags, usually there's a couple of wraps around that plastic. And, you know, you can repair the holes with duct tape or whatever you need to do to keep the oxygen out. Of course, oxygen will also, wherever there's a spot of oxygen in those bags, will just turn to mold, because that's the only thing keeping the mold out is lack of oxygen. At the end of it, you need a ending pH of around 4.5. And at that point, it becomes actually surprisingly stable. I mean, you can keep this stuff for a long time. And that way, so the listeria and mold doesn't grow in it. Some of the advantages of silage is, A, it's a higher protein. And so drought-struck corn has a naturally higher protein, but the silage process actually increases that protein a little bit. And however, even more than that is the relative feed value. And so all forages have some sort of relative feed value. The more lignin and stuff in it, the less the feed value. It's kind of like eating sawdust rather than alfalfa. But doing the silaging process, you actually break down those lignins. And so you tear apart the various celluloses, and so the cows can digest it easier.
Right.
And another big part of that is actually it reduces the nitrates. So drought-struck corn has high nitrates most of the time. It just sucks in too much nitrate, and it has nowhere to process it. It hasn't turned into actual corn, and so it can be toxic to cattle. The silaging reduces those nitrates by 50% on average. And so that's one of the big aspects of silaging, is to take those nitrates out so they're not toxic. The disadvantage, of course, like I talked about, it's the cost and the equipment. And big crop farmers don't often have the cattle operation to feed it to. You can't just make cows out of nothing. And so, right, you know, you have to have somewhere to go with it at the end. And there are some things that you can do kind of in between those. And so balage, for instance, is one of those. You ever see, like, in the pasture, those big marshmallows?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
That's what balage is. And so these big marshmallows, it's really the same process. There's a bale in there that they've wrapped in plastic, and it's a silage silaging at a smaller effect.
Right.
And so the advantage of doing that is there isn't as much specialized equipment when you do that. And a lot of cattle operations, I mean, they have the forklift or whatever they need to do to carry those bales around. They're usually pretty heavy, actually. But at least they're manageable in those big marshmallows. So it doesn't need to be as chopped as much as before. You do have to use a lot of extra wrapping just because when you put it in a bale, there's going to be things sticking out of it and you'll rip that plastic up. Also, you have to be very careful with carrying it from place to place.
Okay, well, we'll come back to that here in just a minute. We are coming up on a break. You're listening to James Coover on here on Greed Side Up. We'll finish it after the subject after the break. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day. Good morning, everybody. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF. We are back with Green Side Up this morning, and we have both in studio James Coover and Jesse Gilmore. Gentlemen, welcome back. And James, we're going to go ahead and let you finish the topic you were talking about just before we had to go to break.
Okay. Yeah, we were talking about silage and basically what you can do with the corn that isn't going to make corn. And I'm expecting corn yields. It's either going to be really good or it's going to be less than 50. So, I mean, it's polar opposites this year when it comes to the corn yields. And if you're dealing with that, sometimes it's not worth it. So you might as well do something with it, make silage. Before the break, we kind of talked about traditional silage, fermenting in the bags. We talked about baleage, which is making a bale and then fermenting it. The other thing that some guys are looking at is can I just bale the corn? Can I just make a normal, like a hay bale out of the corn? What are the issues with that? Because I don't have any of the silage equipment anyway. So there are some disadvantages to that, mostly because corn isn't necessarily made for that kind of endeavor. First of all, it has to get very, very dry if you want to make hay out of corn. And the stalk, of course, it holds moisture. So you got to crush that all up first. That's not terribly hard with a hay conditioner. However, it can take a very long time to dry down. It takes sometimes a week or more to actually dry that corn down to make hay. If you don't, if it's too wet and you bale it, oddly enough, it can actually cause a fire. It's odd to think that there's enough microbial action inside of that bale to heat up to the point where it can ignite. I'm not exactly sure how that happens without the microbes dying before it does that, but it's true. And so you put these wet bales in a barn, it can burn the whole barn down. Also, that well before that point, just a little bit of heat, it actually causes a Millard reaction, and it breaks down the protein. And so just a little bit of heat will break down the protein of the bale, and then you'll just have a bale of nothing really, energy, even though it looks fine. And obviously, like I talked about before, nitrates are going to be a big issue. And so just baling it normal, drought-struck corn naturally has higher nitrates. So it needs to be tested. That doesn't matter whether you're doing silage or just regular bales. You need to test that stuff for nitrates, whether you're going along and sampling from the field or after you bale it, take this forage probe and send those off. And while you're doing that, we're testing for nitrates. We can also test for protein and relative feed value. Make sure that you know exactly what it is you're feeding your cattle so you can balance it. Because the majority of the time, you're not going to be feeding this baled corn just by itself. It's kind of lower protein, a lot of energy, but it needs to be balanced. So really, you know, if you have any questions about drought-struck corn or nutrition or anything like that, we can handle that kind of situation and just talk about what the situation is. And it's not a very common thing around here. This is a lot more silage is done in other parts of Kansas. So when this comes up, people don't really have a whole lot of experience, even though they have the situation that they need to deal with.
Right. So yeah, it's because it's been so dry lately. I mean, we hadn't got too much rain, and when we have got rain, it's been really in short bursts. So
yeah.
I do appreciate you coming in and talking to us about that. And we now have Jesse Gilmore in studio. We were talking to him on the phone earlier, and now in studio. It's a little bit late because the office would not lock, and so finally you're able to get somebody on and finally get it locked. But we appreciate you finally getting in today. And we were talking about trees selection. And you wanted to go ahead and expound on that a little bit more.
Yes. So tree selection is often not really thought of when it comes to landscaping unless you're putting a new landscape in. Particularly in this area, most homes will have mature trees like elms, maples, oaks, that kind of thing. And a lot of people don't really know what to look for in new trees if they were to have a situation where a mature tree would fail to the point where it needs to be removed, like happened in Oswego a couple weekends ago. The first step to tree selection is always to think about a tree's mature size and look around where you want to put the tree. Oftentimes, people will put trees in areas close to power lines, close to homes, too close to homes where the tree will grow into the side of the house, in areas that are not appropriate for a tree's mature size. Instead, they'll look only at the current size of the tree. Dwarf varieties of trees are also a little bit misunderstood in horticulture. Essentially, when a variety is a dwarf variety or cultivar, it will usually be half of the size of a regular tree's mature height and spread. So people who get dwarf pecans, for example, are often confused about why their dwarf pecan is still 35 to 40 feet tall and 35 to 40 feet wide. It's because traditional pecans will get 80 feet tall to 80 feet wide. And so you got to look at the size of the tree first. Usually, and this is kind of an underrated, paradoxically, an underrated quality for trees is what do you want to grow? It's not really going to, it's going to enhance the landscape more if you grow what you want. Of course, you can't make a square peg fit into a round hole. You have to look at other characteristics, size being the biggest one. The other things that you need to consider when selecting for trees are ornamental value. If you're trying to pick one that has good fall color, spring flowers, or some other ornamental quality to them, usually those are what we horticulturalists call specimen trees. You're not going to plant them in large quantities, and often they're going to be the focal point of a landscape, whereas shade trees are often more functional. You do also get some trees that kind of serve a dual purpose, like pecans, producing nuts, and also being a dense shade tree. Basically, figure out what you want and what your the area you want to plant in can allow for. Moisture and pH are going to be the two limiting factors for soil and what can grow there. So what you want to grow, your soil texture, your soil moisture, your soil pH, and what is around the full size of the tree. Those are pretty much the five characteristics that you need to think about when choosing trees.
So a lot goes into selecting a tree than just, oh, I want to put it here, and this tree, I want to put this tree here. There's a lot that goes into it instead of just where you want to put it at. You got to think about it to make sure, one, you don't want it too close to the house, like you said, because I do remember some of the you said when you were going through Oswego, some of the damage you saw like trees like just like falling on houses, and which was sad to see on all parts. Another thing I wanted to ask you about tree selection. So what are some of the most common trees that are that people like to choose? Are you sure about that, or just kind of throwing that out there?
Sure. So most trees that I see, and this is going to vary based on the region in which you live, especially based on climate. I imagine that trees for southeast Kansas are going to vary a lot for northeast Oklahoma, because of general rainfall patterns. So the trees that I see most on the job, sweet gums. Sweet gums are very popular until they start producing those capsules for their seeds. And
yeah.
They fall in the yard. You can't get rid of them.
You step on them, they hurt.
You can't burn them or anything like that. They really have no use. And so I get a lot of calls about how to get rid of those fruiting capsules.
Best way is to rake them, I guess, is the only way I could think about to get rid of them. But yeah, that's what I have in my house.
Yeah.
And I accidentally stepped on one in. Oh, that hurt a little bit.
They're really, really good trees. Strong. You don't see a lot of branch breakage. They don't have disease issues. But it's just that one fatal flaw. And there is one variety that has been bred where you don't run into the seed capsule. And so if you can find that in nurseries or garden centers, get that, because sweet gum is a very good tree. I would say that it's probably a little bit overplanted in like the Crawford County area. I haven't seen it as much in Montgomery or Labette County or Wilson County. Other trees, maples, very popular, good fall color. Most people will opt for silver maples, which are not actually a very good choice because they get very brittle and you start seeing a lot of branch breakage, which can lead to hazard trees pretty early into their lifespan, actually, compared to other trees. So, assess whether or not a tree is a hazard tree, you need to look for branch breakage, potential dieback in the canopy, which could indicate some kind of environmental damage or potential disease. Usually it's going to be more environmental damage for shade trees, and cracks, splits, or decay in the trunk. Saw a lot of that in Oswego, where entire limbs, basically, if a tree loses more than a third of its canopy, it's going to need to be removed because there's 9 times out of 10, it's not going to recover.
Right.
But with silver maples, you do run into issues with that. There are other good maple species like Norway maple, Trident maple. I know that red maples are pretty overplanted where I'm originally from, but down here I haven't seen them as frequently. So maples are a really good choice. There's some really good ornamental maples too, like paper bark maple. That is my hidden gem for trees because it's got this really spectacular looking bark that kind of peels off, and that's natural. There's a lot of different cultivars that you can choose from. It's been a very well-bred maple, and it's not going to get as big. So if you need a smaller tree or don't have the space to grow a shade tree, there's that. There's red buds. There's Chinese fringe trees, I think, stay smaller. There's some really good small selection trees for that. The Kansas Forest Service has a publication for each region in Kansas for preferred trees, except for the Southeast. So I'm working on that with our regional forester right now, trying to get trees that I have seen in our area that will do well and trees that I have not seen in our area that are known to do well in our particular environment. So maples, oaks, obviously oaks are native. They're really good shade trees. You get a lot of different selections based on the particular environment you have. There's about 20 species of oaks that would do well down here, so it's hard to pick. Oaks are generally sorted into reds and whites. You see a lot more reds than you do whites. Usually reds are a lot more tolerant of environmental swings like we've been seeing at the beginning of June and throughout the month of June. But those are typically the three slightly less planted sycamores. You run into disease problems with sycamores, but, foliar disease problems. So it's not going to hurt the tree long term. And they are native to our area. So if you can plant native, unless you're going for a specifically ornamental plant, because the native trees are always going to be more tolerant of climate swings.
Right, especially the way the climate goes around here sometimes. And one more thing I wanted to ask you, and we'll keep this part short, that I've been noticing near my house, bagworms. They've been popping up, and I remember when I used to visit my grandmother down southeastern Oklahoma. during the summer, you would see a ton of these things, and they're starting to pop up quite a bit near my house. And can you just tell us a little bit about bagworms and what they do?
Yes, they eat everything. So bagworms are the larval stage of a moth that will basically spin silk bags combined with plant material and use those to overwinter. Eventually, the following spring, the females stay in their bags, the males emerge as moths, and they go through a new generation, one generation per year. The problem is that when they are in their bags, they're pretty much uncontrollable aside from hand picking. Insecticides will not work once they've started spinning the silk. So you have to pretty much control them before you see them, which is something that is not very common with horticultural pests. Usually you're going to spray in June. Once you start seeing the bags, it's too late. They prefer evergreens like spruces, arborvitae, junipers, and less commonly pines, but they will form their bags on anything plant-related. So deciduous trees, shrubs, sometimes they'll even spin bags on buildings or structures that aren't plants. So they can be house nuisances as well as plant nuisances. Some tips to control bagworms. The upper bags in a plant's canopy are going to be the female bags, and those are more important to control because if you let one go, a female can lay 500 to 1,000 eggs in a bag.
Wow.
And once those hatch, you start getting population issues. The male bags are going to be lower to the ground, which, you know, make it easier for hand picking, but not necessarily for population control. And you want to start spraying in early June. When they've emerged from their bags to start feeding, and they will be too small to see typically in the plant canopy, but one or two sprays should be able to control the generation for the year.
Yeah, like I said, they're starting to like pop up all around near my area, and I was just like, I knew what these were, and I know they pretty much damage that branch of the tree where they're eating, where they're at, because they're, like you said, they eat everything, and it's just I've heard several ways to control. This is one I've heard, and maybe it doesn't work, but I've heard people sawing off the branch where it's at and basically destroying the bagworms. But would that not hurt the tree as well at the same time?
The problem is that they can be so randomly distributed through a canopy that you're not going to get all of them just sawing off a single branch.
Right.
Hand picking is definitely preferable if the plant they're on is small enough. For shade trees, especially ones that you aren't going to be able to reach by hand, they can usually tolerate some defoliation. So one cycle or generation of bagworms is not going to hurt the tree long term, but it is important to note where and when you have bagworms so that you can spray in future growing seasons, because if you let those populations get out of control and continue to feed on these trees, then it can start causing problems for the tree's health. I had one other thing I was going to say about bagworms, but I can't remember it now.
Oh, that's fine. But you gave us plenty of good information about that. Bagworms, those silk bags that they spin, they're pretty prominent when you see those. So, well, guys, before we go, I do want to get back to James real quick. And we'll once again talk about the pickle party that is coming up on August 15th.
Yes. The pickle party, talk about fermentation of silage, fermentation of pickles. And so the pickle party will be on August 15th at the Oswego Community Center, and that will be from 1 to 4 o'clock on August the 15th. Just give us a call, and we'll get you signed up for it.
And it'll be a lot of fun, like you said, at the Oswego Community Center. And the good thing is face masks and gloves will be provided for food safety and COVID protocols. So that'll be a good thing. And today is also on, I don't know if you're on it today, Jesse, but as the the garden thing on the K-State thing today, correct?
Yes, and this is probably the K-State Garden Hour webinar that I would recommend most because it's specifically on pesticide label safety. So essentially, it's how to read and interpret a pesticide label to figure out whether or not you need personal protective equipment when applying it, basic safety for different, you know, people, insects that you are beneficial and you want to keep alive, plant drift and stuff like that. It runs through all of that. And I think that's applicable to more than just homeowners or mm-hmm. horticultural enthusiasts. It can have applications for agronomic crop growers and other basic anyone who is applying an herbicide or insecticide. So you can register for that on the Horticulture and Natural Resources website at K-State. The webinar is from 12 to 1, and if you register but can't make it, a recording is provided for you to go back and watch.
So be sure to check out that webinar, and that's today, correct?
Yes.
At noon. So be sure to watch that. And again, if you do register and can't make it, there will be a recording provided for you so that you can watch at your earliest convenience. Well, guys, I thank you very much for coming in today. It was good to see James. I hadn't seen him in quite a while. Got to see Jesse a couple of weeks back, but it's good to see you guys in studio. We will talk to you guys in a few weeks.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take a break. When we come back, we're going to kick off Open Line. You're listening to the Mighty 690 KGGF here on this hump day.